Your goal is simply to book a meeting. You know, you're not trying to close a deal through one email. Like, it's like, how can I just get on the phone with somebody? And that's the goal.
It's not referencing the weather in Seattle or that you got promoted. Personalization is being contextually relevant to the person. This is how your mind should be thinking. It's like, I saw your 100 person company with 9 engineers on your team and no QA engineers. You're probably going through this. And then you go, and here's a solution for it.
Welcome to Engineering Founders, the show for engineering leaders making the daring leap to start their own company. This is a special episode featuring a conversation from our show, Engineering Founders, the show for engineering leaders making the daring leap to start their own company. If you're looking to break away from engineering leadership and start your own company, this is the show for you. We cover the stories, the pivotal moments, and critical insights from former engineering leaders turned founders that help them take the earliest steps to launch their company. You know, the stuff that's not talked about often, and it's often difficult to get exposed to when you're strictly leading engineering teams. You can find Engineering Founders wherever you get podcasts, on Spotify, Apple, or your favorite podcast platform. That's Engineering Founders. Check it out. The link to the show is in the description. Click the link and subscribe. Enjoy our conversation with John Pearl and Scott Wilson. John, Scott, welcome. Thanks so much for coming to hang out on a Tuesday. How are you both doing? What's going on?
Doing great. Got one of our amazing team members in town. It's great to see him. And we're going to go to a hockey game tonight. So looking forward to that. It's going to be fun day all around.
The Seattle Kraken. You got to love it.
Yeah, Kraken are awesome. And it's a beautiful day in Seattle. I think it was national news. It was like a monsoon for the last like 4 days straight. Just like dumping rain. And then today it's just like all sun. Good day to get out, walk around, go to a Kraken game.
I get that. I'm downstream of all the storms that you get over in North Idaho. So my Sunday was spent, I spent about 6 hours like shoveling snow, clearing out a driveway. Then my car got stuck in a snowbank. So a monsoon was actually like a big snowstorm blizzard for me. So to jump into the topic, so we've got a lot of things we want to cover. But I think to begin this exploration, it's probably good to start with a little bit of context. So I was wondering if you both could bring us into the origin story behind QA Wolf. And then what we're going to do is we'll spend some time deconstructing different moments of the journey and some of the insights or lessons folks can apply. So bring us in, like back to the beginning of QA Wolf. What happened? What caused the idea? Take it away.
I guess I'll start with that. My background, I've been coding really hardcore since high school. Ended up leading engineering at a few different organizations. And I've run into the QA problem many times, but there's one point in time that like it really hit me in the face. We were just starting to scale up at this company I led engineering for in Boston called Dispatch. At Dispatch, we managed the logistics for plumbers, contractors, people that would go to your home and fix stuff. And we were scaling up with our first enterprise customer. We didn't really have a good QA process in place. And they had about 30,000 contractors that were relying on our software to figure out what jobs they need to go to. And I shipped a bug that broke our entire platform and like 30,000 plumbers and contractors couldn't figure out where to go, which was like an absolutely horrible day. And I felt, you know, terrible. And obviously the CEO is pissed at me. And that led me on the journey of like, I can never let this happen again. So that I think was like, you know, if there's one point in time that was kind of like the very origin of the pain of QA that I felt it most acutely. From there, it was just a matter of like, okay, well, how do we solve this problem? And realizing that all of the solutions out there were bad. The thing that got me passionate about coding is that you can take something like a manual process and automate it and save people time, and they don't have to waste their time doing stuff that you can automate with technology. And that's very powerful. So, you know, naturally, it's like, how can I build an automated QA process? That was the first thing that I jumped to solve that problem. And I ended up hiring experts in automated testing because I figured we didn't have that expertise in-house. So we had money. I was like, let's just throw money at this problem. Let's set up an automated QA process. We invested about $60,000, but only got like 20 tests when we needed about 200 tests. And those tests were really slow to run. They would fail all the time. So we ended up having to invest a ton of time investigating failures, and maintaining the test was a total pain. It like dragged the engineering team's time. So it like the ROI just wasn't there to have this automated QA process. In my mind, it would have been a fast, quick thing that wouldn't require high maintenance, but it was like total pain. So we ended up doing manual QA. We hired a small manual QA team, and then we would only release every few weeks. But that problem, you know, I never found a good solution there. I ended up leading engineering at another healthcare startup in New York called ZipDrug. And there we ended up trying to set up automated tests again with like the latest technology. Cypress was like the new thing at the time. You know, it was better, but we ran into the same problem. So we ended up just doing manual QA. After ZipDrug got acquired, our other co-founder, Laura, she was one of the first engineers at a healthcare startup in New York called CityBlock. And they would ship bugs that would break their platform, which was relied on by their team to sign up patients and take care of patients. So they would ship bugs and like they literally couldn't sign up new patients. We were both surprised that this problem hadn't been solved. It felt like something that if we could actually solve that problem, it would be really awesome since we both faced it. And so we decided to start QA Wolf. I won't even get into, like, I don't know, we can go through all the different chapters. We tried a bunch of different stuff. We tried to build AI. We spent many months on that. We had some interesting experiments, but nothing like real that we could use with customers. And we decided that we need to stop doing this and we need to ship something useful. So we quickly built an open source tool to make it faster to set up tests. We scaled that up. We got a lot of users using it. And that's what led to our first round of funding. And we decided to solve the problems that our users were using with that open source tool. We ended up building a platform that they could pay for. And we brought on Scott because Laura and I are both engineers and we realized we really needed someone to focus full time on sales and marketing. And it was either going to be one of us or we need to bring on someone to do that. Scott had been leading marketing at Wise. He helped scale them from zero to millions of customers. And I actually know Scott back from college. We met in the entrepreneurship dorm at Purdue. We brought Scott on to help us figure out how to sell this platform. And there is a ton of learnings from that. So I'm sure we can get into that.
You know, I'm imagining people listening here are probably playing back every moment of trauma they've ever had shipping a bug that crashes their platform. Because it's such an emotional thing. It's like, it's hard not to feel blame around being the cause of that. And for you to kind of share, like, not only that, like finding a co-founder who've experienced the same challenge and then to like devote like the mission to helping make sure people don't feel that same challenge, I think is really powerful. And then like, I'm also thinking about like one of my favorite events we ever did was like a Halloween horror stories themed event where people would share sort of like their bugs and outages moments. And it became this like roundtable sort of lightning discussion where people were sharing just like the worst stories and like similar sort of moments where they ended up deleting an email list of a million users or something like that. It just like completely gone, disappeared, irrecoverable. And so it's just like you hear those stories all the time. And so you think about the cost and the impact of this problem, like it is pervasive across the industry and like everybody feels it. So it's just like my initial reaction to what you shared there. But Scott, this brought you in to come together. So would love to hear like, how did you get linked up to this and like, what about this problem got you so excited?
I mentioned I'm going to be authentic in my answers, so I will be. I'll share kind of how I came here, what I was thinking, the excitement, et cetera, right? John and I, as John mentioned, we met back in college, and we've always been really, really great friends. And we would check in maybe once a quarter, just kind of like see how each other are doing. And I knew he'd been working on QA Wolf, or I didn't know it was called QA Wolf. I knew he'd been working on this QA solution for quite a while. And I was one of the early hires at Wise. Wise was a very interesting time. It was a very awesome place because, you know, one of their position statements is they sell really great technology for a really low price. And what that means is there's no margin for marketing. And so what do you have to do? When you're the marketer for a company that doesn't really have a budget for marketing, well, you have to be extremely resourceful and just like really understand the fundamentals of just market, how to get in front of people, why people buy, et cetera. So I learned a ton there. Learned a ton from Amazon about how to be customer centric. And, you know, I was looking to move on from Wise and I was touching base with John and, you know, John mentioned this opportunity. And I remember talking to my wife. She knows I've always wanted to work with John. That's always been something I've wanted to work with. He's always been like the most entrepreneurial person I've known. And then on top of that, not only just entrepreneurial, just like one of the smartest developers and like strategic thinkers I've ever known. I've always thought that would be cool. And Connie was like, just do it. Let's jump in and get going. And so QA, honestly, I didn't know too much about QA. At Wise, I did manual QA. I didn't know it was called manual QA though. We would all get into a conference room. The marketers, the product managers, the engineers, and we would QA the app. So it's a smart home app that connects to your phone. And we did this like every single release and like even like times beyond that, because you're always just trying to make sure the app works. I was like, man, that is an interesting problem. There's a way to like do this automated. And so something that really excites me is the thrill of solving an unsolved problem. And fortunately, you know, QA was that problem for me. And you know, I love that idea. But, you know, the early day, I'm the non-technical co-founder on the team. I know sales and marketing. I do not know JavaScript or development or anything. And so I was like, man, I need to catch up. You know, there's even a moment where John started teaching me JavaScript. I was sitting in his front yard, like with my laptop, and he was pacing back and forth talking about like for loops or like all this other stuff that I was frantically trying to take notes. I don't know how that was going to work. But I was like, there's got to be a better way to be able to do this. So it was during this time when I was having some personal thoughts of being like, man, how can I bow out gracefully? You know, I'm John's friend. I don't want to ruin our relationship, but I think you have to be an engineer to be able to sell to engineers. And I very adamantly thought about that. And then I was just like, you know what? I shouldn't be thinking like that. And so I wrote the word persist on a sticky note and I put it on my monitor. I was like, you know, the people that win are the people that persist. You only lose when you stop. And so I was like, all right, how am I going to become like dangerous enough to like be able to talk to people? So I watched every single LinkedIn course I could on the software development lifecycle and quality assurance. I tried to look at every single Udemy course I could. I looked at like every I looked at tutorials of Selenium, and then I used QA Wolf. I was like, man, that's the difference. Then I looked at Cypress. Then I was just doing every single thing I could to just really understand. And then this may be getting into future questions, but then I was like, man, what if I just pay someone to talk to them and like learn from them?
A quick reaction here, like, you know, thinking about John, like the early days, like, because sometimes we devolve into like, you know, how do you find co-founders and how does that relationship get set up? Like, Scott, like, I'm going to deconstruct a couple of things that become apparent here. If I'm hiring I'm bringing in a co-founder and like trying to find the right person, like the person who's willing to persist and like to go above and beyond and learn something to be just good enough to be dangerous is like probably a really hard skill to find, like a really hard, like, how do you test for that, right? Like for a co-founder, like that's such a hard thing. But so I'm thinking like, man, how do I find a character like Scott who is willing to learn and dive into all these courses so that he deeply understands like the perspective of like the people being served? That to me is like such a critical quality for finding a co-founder. I don't know, John, if you feel the same way, if that was like something you knew explicitly and then like Scott just proves that in like all caps just in the process.
Yeah, so something unique about Scott that is really hard to find is he reads more than anybody else I know. I don't know if you still do this, but Scott used to wake up at like 6 a.m. or like 5 in the morning to read a book before work. Like we would talk about X topic and say, oh, well, did you read this book about it? So Scott has always had this like thirst for knowledge that you might not know how to do something, but if you learn from the best, that's how you end up becoming the best. And I think that's a superpower that Scott has. I also remember Scott back in college, he sold like painting houses door to door, which to be able to do that requires fortitude and just raw sales ability. He's always been a hustler since I've known him. He's always been a really hard worker. We kept in touch since college. I think Scott was thinking about starting another company and I was like, well, you know, have an interest in joining QA Wolf, we'll make it worth your while. He had done some really incredible things with Wise, you know, at Amazon. So having someone who knows marketing, is a really hard worker, I trust deeply, it was like a no-brainer and really exciting to get the opportunity to work together. Little did we know how hard it was going to be. You know, it was very rosy. I think when I asked Scott to join us and we're like, oh, well, we'll get to a million AR in, you know, 18 months. We were so far away from that. The naivety was sort of, I think, important to our success or to not realize like what we had in front of us.
I just think about like the approach, like how do you increase the odds of success of finding a great, like a great hire in general? It's like looking for the evidence of like the type of qualities that you want. So like thinking about like all of the evidence that you shared of like Scott's background for like persistence above and beyond, like willingness to learn, resilience, like willingness to do the hard work. These are like the things that people like, I feel like write the blog posts about how to find an ideal co-founder. But then like the process of like, well, how do you find that person? Or like, what do you actually look for? Like the stories you're sharing about Scott, like and how that was personified, like, that's the map. Like you're looking for the evidence of those qualities and like how that person lives their life and their different interactions. Scott, well, I know we're gushing about you.
Thank you. Yeah, I appreciate it.
You know, I think trust is probably the most important thing. Because in working through, like there's definitely, it's very much a roller coaster. And I feel like it's more down than up at the beginning. And being able to work through that, being able to persist, having that foundation of trust and being able to like get through hard conversations and know that there's more goodwill, you know, you definitely need to work with people, not only that you trust, but are also very competent and skilled and hardworking. I think those are like the three, you know, sort of areas the most important. It's hard to put one above the other, but trust is also a really, really important thing. And it's hard to just develop that quickly. It's much easier if you have a history together.
We have a lot of stories to get into. Scott, you previewed one a little bit, and it's this story of developing like an approach to pay people to learn from. And so I was wondering if you could set up like, what's the story there? And what was like the intended outcome for how it was supposed to impact like the early days of QA Wolf? And like, what did you learn and what was the impact of that?
Yeah, I think, you know, one thing that I think John was really good at that I learned from is like talking in terms of problem statements, because there are multiple solutions to a single problem statement. And one of them is, how do you sell this thing, right? Like, and then, you know, this might get into future questions as well, but it's like, when the question is, how do you sell this thing? You have 1,000 things in front of you. You know, I do some mentoring at University of Washington, and I was asked, this team asked me, they're like, you know, how do I get that answer? I go, have you asked them? And they're like, no, I didn't know that was on the table. One of the biggest things in marketing and sales, everyone probably says it, but I really, really believe it, is like empathy. The more you can know what someone is going through, like their day-to-day, their personal goals, their business goals, just everything, the more you can truly like visualize as hard as possible, then you can help create a solution for that. But if we're over here just kind of like minding our own business, hoping our solutions are going to solve these things without talking, it's like, man, so I was like, yeah, how do I talk to these people? Cold outreach just to talk, it wasn't working. I always try to, John is really good at this as well, is like, if you reach out to 20 people and 20 don't respond, you got to change something. And I was doing that. I was like, man, I'm not getting what I need. And so I was like, I'm going to start putting some incentive behind it. I think I joined like 3 QA engineering LinkedIn groups. You press join, and then, you know, you got to wait like 48 hours for the admin to approve you, and you got to answer why you're joining the group. And it's like, man, I wish I could just do this in a minute. So you got to kind of have that patience, and like, you probably want to join all of them up front. I think I did a couple Facebook, and I just posted. I'm like, hey, we're trying to start a business here to like help out the QA world. Some people were like, yeah, dude, just give me $20, or like, hey, I'll do it for free. Like, I had no idea. So I was just like, I'll do $50 for 30 minutes of your time or whatever. I just want to interview over Zoom. That's all I want to do. And I got like a handful of calls. And you start off asking questions that I realize, I'm like, man, these questions don't mean anything. And then as they start telling you stuff, you know, your next interview, you ask more intentional questions. You know, the general theme is like, you know, if I'm just being, again, authentic, is like, hey, what do you not necessarily like about your job? What do you wish was different about your job and your role? How do other people view your role at the company? How do you view your relationship with the engineers? Not trying to lead stuff, but just truly understanding. And then you start realizing like, oh, of all the people I talked to, they didn't really have any incentives at their business. And so if they don't have incentives, then they're probably not trying to do X, Y, and Z. They're probably doing what's given to them. So that leaves a gap of like what the business needs. So anyway, yeah. So that, you know, that's kind of the short of it is, if you don't know the answer to something, like, go out and pay to expedite that knowledge. And so we've done that a number of times. We've done that with email deliverability. We've done that with paid media, because there are people out there. And if you have the means, try to pay for that knowledge instead of trying to learn it over like 2 years.
You're talking about cold email wasn't working. And I think that's probably a big point of anxiety for folks listening in here and like making that transition where like they're not in that environment of doing cold email. And I know that like this was probably one of like a larger approach that you were doing to help even get meetings to begin with, to begin to understand like the customer persona. And so I was wondering if you guys could dive in a little bit deeper to some of the lessons you learned about cold email, maybe some of the myths that exist and some of the different approaches or tactics or strategies that you found effective like in this space.
So yeah, this is something I knew nothing about, but the first major lesson was like quality over spam. As an engineer, I was thinking, you know, we're getting a small response rate, so let's just scale up how many emails we can send, and let's bring in all the tooling to automate the process to reach more people. In reality, what you should be doing is like, if people aren't responding to you, then you're either targeting the wrong people or your message isn't resonating, and you should be experimenting with that. And, you know, there's a question of like whether or not we should personalize email, I think, when we're first starting, or like how personalized should be. And it's like, every email should be personalized. Stop trying to automate this thing. Like, really, the process of figuring out cold emailing is trying different messaging and being very personal and trying to figure out how this person's really going to realize you're not a robot, because no one's going to respond to a robot. The other thing that I would say is, you know, beyond really focusing on personalizing and reaching the right people and the messaging, is that your goal is simply to book a meeting. You know, you're not trying to close a deal through one email. Like, it's like, how can I just get on the phone with somebody? And that's the goal. These are sort of basic things, but, you know, things I didn't know when we were starting to try and cold email.
You know, it continues to be an exciting part of like my role to, you know, because other people are listening to this. You know, one thing I've always wanted to change in like the marketing world or like the mentoring or coaching world is like, there is no overnight success. It really is like a very long time, and then something happens. I am by no means going to say we have like a golden goose or like we know exactly what to do, but I will share some of like the interesting learnings. When we started, you know, the first question that I remember struggling with John and Laura for so long is like, do we focus on inbound leads or do we go after net new outbound? because when we started, it was like a it was a self-serve tool, and it was like a freemium. You come in, and we had a lot of like people coming inbound, but you know, we weren't really converting them to paid, et cetera. And so we did decide to go for outbound. Now the question is like, how do you reach people? And if you're talking in problem statements again, it's like, how do you get in front of people? And so, you know, we got our first 1 million ARR by email, really. John and I did cold calling once, and John connected with one person. It was actually the very first person John ever called he connected with. And the guy was just telling us everything. And then John eventually hung up because he didn't know. This is before we knew like how to run sales. And so John was just like, all right, well.
I was shocked. He picked up.
Yeah. I just remember because the guy was like, yeah, like I got a QA problem and I got, you know, all this. And then we just didn't know where to take it. And but you know, that creates the funny story. But also, not only does it create the funny, it breaks the ice. It's like, this is part of the gig, you know? You got to have a couple like train wrecks to like get good at something. And so, you know, when we first started cold emailing, I sent 800 emails in like 2 days, and no one responded. And I think one of the learning, John kind of touched on it. If no one responds, it's on you. It's not on them. You know, as a salesperson, you need to realize that the market is silently giving you feedback that your stuff isn't good. It might be the wrong person. It might be the wrong time. It might be the wrong message. It's usually one of those three or multiple of those. And so just like really understand that and take that in and then continue to be a little different with it. So a couple of things we did that didn't work is we over-explained. Because it's like, man, I only got one shot to reach out to this person, so I want to tell them everything. And I remember John and Laura being like, you sent them what? But I was like, yeah, we're going to attend every stand-up you're on. We're going to like be talking to you on Zoom every day if you need to. I was trying to convey like, we're going to be everything you need. But what we eventually learned is like that, first off, like you're assuming what they want, which you should not, which is the point of a meeting. The point of a meeting is to be like, hey, what do you want? Do you even need us? But when you go so heavy with a cold email like that, you're limiting who's going to be interested because they're like, I don't, who is this person that wants to be on every single stand-up? Like, get away. So that's one lesson learned is don't over-explain. Just have enough to be like, hey, I think I know what you're going through. And I'm pretty sure we have a solution that would work for you because it's worked for others. Another thing I did was over researching. I watched someone's like 20-minute YouTube video and then I like referenced it. That went nowhere. And I did that for a couple of people and I was like, man, there's got to be a better way. We even, you know, I think this was Laura's idea, was we called it Test Fairy, where we would unsolicited create a test on their website, do a video and then send it to them to show some like, hey, we're real and like we have value. That did okay, but it wasn't like groundbreaking. But that was like an incremental step to being like, you know, there's something to adding value in an email. And then what does like adding value mean? This is when we started getting good and like more mature and the things we do today. Like, so one thing that was very important is experimentation. And this was John's idea. It's like, and this is what it comes to now. If you reach out to 50 people and you book no meetings, you got to change it up. Don't wait until you send 800 emails like I did. If you send 50 and you're not even getting a response, that means something's up, whether it's your email deliverability or your subject line or, you know, something's up. And so you always want to like have these perimeters and they need to be hard stops. Maybe that means you change your subject line. That's all it means. Who knows what it means? That's up to you. But you should have these hard parameters that allow you to like keep yourself accountable. Another thing that I found was very helpful was, even though we're reaching out to CTOs and VPs of engineering, and this has to do with all sales, they don't intimately know QA. So they don't know that to get to 80% coverage, typically with an in-house team, it might take 2 years and 10 QA engineers. They don't know that. So if you say, hey, we're QA Wolf, we do 80% coverage in a couple weeks or months or whatever, they're like, cool, I bet everyone else does as well. Like you have to proactively educate that, hey, that actually isn't the case. And so, you know, a couple of ways to do that is you can say like, we have a unique way, or we are the first two. And when you like start off a sentence with those, they're like, oh, okay. QA has been around for decades. You know, you can argue whether or not it's been like super innovated, you know, since it came out. And so a lot of people are kind of burned by traditional QA, or they've seen the same pitch for the last like 20, 30 years. And so how do you differentiate above that? When you talk about personalized emails, it's not referencing the weather in Seattle or that you went to Purdue or that you got promoted. Personalization is being contextually relevant to the person. So, hey, I saw, you know, you don't have to say this, but this is how your mind should be thinking. It's like, I saw your 100-person company with 9 engineers on your team and no QA engineers. You're probably going through this. A couple things that does. One, they go, I am going through that. Or it goes, man, I guess I am. I didn't know I was. And then you go, and here's a solution for it. If you're able to do that from publicly available information, be contextually relevant, versus saying like, hey, you know, hope the sunny day in Seattle with 82 degrees is going well for you. It's like, dude, come on. Like, that doesn't mean anything. But if you, you know, this is why I tell my sales team as well, because it does come down to empathy, right? I go, God, you know, their goal, if their goal is to book meetings and someone came to them and they go like, hey, John, I have a tool that will book you 4 meetings a month with VPs of engineering at SaaS companies. They'd forward that to me so fast, right? Because it's so contextually relevant because that person knows what their goal is. It knows who their ICP is. It's talking directly to them. And so in our experience, we have to do the same with VPs of engineering. So anyway, if they have a huge change log, we know that they're releasing stuff really quickly. So it's really just knowing kind of who your prospect is, where they're at, and just really understanding what their specific goals are, given as much as you can see from public information.
I think you get there over time. Like, we didn't know anything going into this, right? But like persisting and doing a horrible job and making all these mistakes led us to learning how to book meetings and how to learn about people's problems and how to replicate that and realize like, how is that consistent? So I do think it's just a matter of getting one step at a time, getting in front of people, learning how to have conversations, learning what their true problems are. And it was really helpful to have Scott on our team because I think as an engineer, all you're kind of thinking is, well, I have this beautiful, perfect solution that we're going to build. And we just need to learn how to just like sell that thing. But that's not really the case when you're starting a company. It's very much like you should be figuring out what are the pains people are having that they're willing to pay for and then building to solve that problem. And that's really like not what we started doing until Scott joined. And there's a whole story there. But like until we started, you know, really solving real pains that people were willing to pay for, that's when we hit product market fit. And that's when we were able to scale up quickly and get to a million in ARR really quickly. But yeah, you can't force a solution down someone's throat. That's not sales.
Related to that last insight, John, I want to bring up the story about like, there was a moment that you had shared with me where you all had stopped coding and then focused on like the sales and the outreach and the learning to help identify like how to build that better solution. Can you share about that moment and what it was like making that decision? And then how did you orient the team to focus on that new objective, like stopping coding and then moving forward with a different objective?
Yeah, so something we started, this was Laura's idea. We got it from the Airbnb founders. They would send a weekly update to their investors with a chart on it that had their MRR goal, like monthly recurring revenue goal, and where they were at. And they'd send that every week. And so after we launched the platform, we decided to start doing that. And we had this, you know, MRR goal of 80,000 in MRR, you know, trying to hit a million ARR. And we would send that week after week. Scott joined us and, you know, it was around like we started sending them. And it was like $50 MRR and then like $100 MRR. And I think we got up to like a few hundred dollars MRR, maybe like $1,000. And it felt like we were just never going to get there. We were just never going to get to our goal with what we were doing. And, you know, we sent the weekly update not because our investors were asking for it, but it was really to hold ourselves accountable. It was so painful to send that, actually. Like, it was embarrassing. It felt hopeless every time we would send it, but enough of those and enough like, oh, well, let's try this and then that'll solve it and those things not working, then you do a little bit of soul searching. I don't know if it was me or if it was Laura or Scott. I don't remember who, but there was a point where we sent enough weekly updates where like with no progress, they were like, fuck, we need to stop building. This shit's not working.
You know, we didn't have really any sales. And John was like, I'm gonna make sure we have the best infrastructure ever. And I was like, for who? I just remember him sitting down and being like, oh my God, like it all clicked. You know, because like in my, you know, I'm going to speak for them really quick, but product is something you can control, right? Like it's something you can sit in front of and create and control yourself, but sales, you cannot. It's very hard. And I think that was like a breakthrough moment where I was like, why? Like, what are you going to, we're at a really good place where this product works and it creates value. But I will say, like, you know, John mentioned earlier, to be able to give and receive candid feedback like that and trust each other enough to do that, I think is the difference between like good and great teams. And you know, that's something that's been like something that John really drives, is like just being super open, because that is how you get better. And when I'm able to have that kind of conversation with John and my team with me, it's like, man, you're right. And then also being like humble enough or like open enough to be like, yeah, you are right. Like, you know, I don't know everything. So yeah, but I remember that being a funny moment.
My follow-up question here is like, would you recommend making these accountability mechanisms a core part of how you operate in an early stage team? And what do you think would be the most essential thing to do to make that happen?
I think it's super simple. Just send a weekly update to your investors or to your, you know, somebody like accountability buddies And yeah, it's very useful. I mean, it saved our company, probably. And then just stop fooling yourself. You can't live in la-la land. The numbers don't lie. If nothing changes, it's not going to turn around. Like, you're not just going to magically, you know, get picked up by some news article and then everything changes. That's just not like how the world works. So I think, yeah, just being okay with realizing that's part of the journey. That's like part of finding product market fit, is you don't know what is going to be successful. And I feel like it's, you know, a common trope, but it really is like solve sales and then build the product for enterprise software. I think that's very much true. Talk to more users, do less coding. Like I tell this, I have a lot of different startup founders that we get introduced to. And it's like the same thing I say on every single call. Like you should probably stop building what you're building and like get lunch with people in New York. If you reach out and say like, hey, I want to like talk to you because you have this expertise. Like, would you be one? I'd love to buy you lunch. A lot of people will say yes. I get on these calls, you know, people reach out to me and I do Zoom calls to be helpful because I want to pay it forward. And like, that's how successful people feel. They want to help out other people and you can learn so much from them. These are things I would actually pay for. And I think having those conversations, it's actually way easier. You just need to get over the fear of talking to people as an engineer.
The next story I want to dive into. So I don't know if this is like two different stories or one story together, but it's sort of the element of the false signal of free users. Like, I want to dig into that. And then the other side of it is like getting to the moment where you get the insight to expand from product to product and services. And so I don't know like if there are two stories there or if there are different moments of insight, but those are the two things that I would love to dive into.
I'm pretty blessed to have like a really good network. And one of those people is, I believe, our first customer as well. He's a good friend. And I was mentioning QA Wolf, the product itself, like the free self-serve version. And he was like, I think it's a really great product, but I don't have time to use it. And he was a really great like backboard for ideas and what we're doing. So, you know, kind of said that. And then we kept iterating. And then I came back. I was like, you know, you told me you need QA, but you don't want to do it yourself. I was like, what if we do it for you? But we do it for you in a fraction of the time your team can do it, but also a fraction of the cost. He was like, that sounds too good to be true, but let's do it. And so it was very interesting because kind of going back to having those relationships where people are real with you. He was like, it's great, but I don't got time for it. He's a CTO. And, you know, I'm not going to try to be like, but come on, you know, you sure you're not going to use? No, he told me that's the market. He's telling me he won't. And so I was like, what can we do to make him do it? So it was me, John, and Laura in a townhome guest room doing this when we were kicking things off. And I was like, John, you know, when we had the self-serve, I was like, how many QA Wolf tests have you created yourself for QA Wolf? He was like, none. I hate writing tests. And I was like, my God, you're the CEO of this, like, because the whole idea was, you know, create tests 10 times faster. If you're the one that has the passion to create this thing, but you're not doing it, I think there's just like this, you know, as a non-technical person, I'm like, I love, love, love creating like complex Excel spreadsheets, but I hate testing them. I was like, I think humans just like to create and innovate. And then I asked John that, and I was like, oh man, like ding, ding, ding. I think there's something there. And then we pitched it to my other friend, the CTO, and he was like, yeah, that's like, if you can do that, that would be sick. And so that's my recollection of kind of like my personal thinking of how we transitioned from like the self-serve to also like during the self-serve, we had a lot of people using self-serve. Like John and Laura built a fantastic product. The thing is, they were not using it to the potential that it could be. They were only creating like a handful of tests when we knew they should be creating hundreds of tests. And then, you know, kind of going back to when we were interviewing people, we would talk to some of these people that are using the platform and they'd be like, you know, I'm not really incentivized to create more than I have right there. And it's like, oh man, like there's a gap in the business. But that's my recollection. John, I'm curious of your point of view as well.
That's exactly how I remember it too. And then it was like that point, and like 3 months later, we had a million in AR. You know, it was like zero to a million in 3 months from that point on. And then it was figuring out how the hell to scale that. Because we were definitely not, and that was the next, I mean, that's still today, but it was a really crazy first few months. I was actually against it. That's the other thing I'd add to this. Because I'm like, no, let's not do this. Lauren Scott wanted to do it. And I was like, no, we shouldn't do this. It's not scalable. We won't be a software business. Like all the things investors think of, and like, it's gonna be hard. And it's interesting because I feel like all the reasons not to do something, you know, your like first reaction, like maybe those are all opportunities because those are all problems why people are not doing it. But thankfully, Scott and Laura were very much on board. I was like, okay, you know, if you both want to do it, like, let's try it. It's stupid. No, not that. But I was like, but I was definitely like, I do remember being the one out, like those two wanted to do it. I was like, okay, well, if both of you want to do it, let's do it. And then it was like, oh my gosh, I can't imagine. Like, if we not, we'd be out of business by now.
I want to add that the level of like open-mindedness is so important. It goes back to the cold email and getting the message right, getting the uniqueness of your positioning right. And what John said as well is like, kind of like, you know, do selling and then do more additional product work. One thing we did is started trying different value propositions in emails. So like 50 emails would have this one. And then eventually, and I was like, man, 80% coverage in like 4 months, like, will that work? And so I sent it and I got a reply and I was like, oh shoot. And then I got another reply. I was like, John, Laura, can we do this? And they're like, we're going to make it work. You know, when I came on, I was like, I told John, I don't know like much about this at all, but I am going to make it work. John and Laura had the same attitude of like, you know, we've never done that before, but that's what the market wants. And we have the expertise to go that way. So let's do it. You know, and like, what did that cost? What does that cost a founder reaching out with a value proposition to test the market? And then when they respond, it's like, this is what the market wants, build towards it versus building in the dark, launching it. And then the market being like, 6 months ago, I wish you would have gone the, you know, zigs instead of zag.
I'd love to get like a sense of like the early test for like the product and services strategy. So like when you're first testing out like the services approach, we probably don't have time to go like super deep into it, but just like, I would love like that initial reaction for like, what did the test look like? And then how did you start to think about like the thesis for scaling that?
We were not scientific about it. It was like, we have, I don't know, maybe like $500 of MRR and Scott, you know, our friend is want to pay us $5,000, like 10 times all of our revenue. So that's really interesting. Like, that's super interesting. You know, is he the only one? And then once we got a few more people, I was like, okay, we're going this way. This is how we're going to get to a million. That's how we're going to hit our goal. It was obvious. It was obvious we should not do what the hell we were doing before. So it wasn't super scientific, but I think it was very clear that dollars don't lie. He wouldn't pay $5,000 if we weren't delivering $5,000 value, even though he's a great friend, or at least multiple people wouldn't. Really, since that point, it's just been the market pooling product to solve their problems and us answering it and figuring out how to go. You know, we start off the company pure tech, starting with the technology and working your way backwards to like sales. That's like so the wrong way to go about it. You know, we've completely switched to starting with what is the problem that companies face, and then how do you solve that problem with whatever technology possible? It doesn't even matter if there's no tech, but if you can solve their pain points, then like you can figure out which things are actually even worth building. I've done a lot of A/B testing. I think there's like good places for it, but when you talk about fundamental strategy, you kind of have to go with your gut. It's not like there's a clear number that this is how we're gonna change the whole business. It just, this felt like the right thing to do. But I think the open-mindedness that Scott mentioned, like, is just very important.
This is where like leadership or the rubber meets the road type of thing. I remember walking with John and my wife, we were walking along the water, like when we first like sold like one or two of these accounts. And it's like, it's exciting. But the question is like, how many more are there of this? And you don't know as a founder, will you only ever get to a million ARR and that's it? But the thing is, you have to, in John's big thing, which I love, is focus. You have to decide on a path and go that way. And, you know, that's what we did. And I remember being a very scary thing. It's like, are we overcommitting the wrong way? Because not only do you lose money and resources, you lose time. And if you're going the wrong way, someone is going to go the right way and possibly pass you. And so that is a scary thing as like a founder is like, man, are you committing to the right direction? But going back to John, if you know what the customer problem, the industry problem is, you know, our solution may be different in a year, right? Like look what COVID changed, like every solution out there, because you have to adapt to the market. But if you always know the consistent problem of the market, your solution will adapt to it. It's so hard to tell, but you just kind of have to commit and go with it.
Yeah, we cut off our self-serve. I mean, we were cool with them. We had a long time, but I was like, let's burn the bridges, you know, tell them this is going to shut down in X months, like make it a good transition for them. And then we made it much longer, but like we need to burn the bridges and we need to make this work. And still like focus, I think, is an ongoing problem. Setting the right priorities and making sure that you're not doing too much. I think complexity kills companies, definitely at the early days too. So I very much agree with you, Scott.
The last question I want to ask to sort of wrap up the point of time we are at with QA Wolf is, you know, this big insight that's led to the signal for product market fit and these massive results. And I think there's a lot of companies that are sitting at this like this interesting moment in time in terms of like how technology is evolving. And so I'd love to get like a sense, you know, John, you and I were talking about like with AI advancements, like services, maybe an interesting thing to consider for folks starting these types of companies. And so would love just to get a sense of like both your perspective on like why maybe considering services with like what you said, John, where all of the reasons are a manual process, there are challenges with scaling that these investors may share, may be smart with some of the advancements going on. Like how might that lead to an operating advantage? Like what are your thoughts on that?
Investors really chase trends. I would not use the trends of investors to do your own company, but really use the customer problems because they're the ones who are going to give you money in and help you build a durable business. If you really deeply understand any problem today, like the thing that got me excited about coding is just the power that you can code something and automate something and give people back their time. And you have like certain APIs you can access and use those to build programs. Like now what you can do has just expanded tenfold. Things that were not possible to automate now are either possible or like they're gonna be possible in the next few years. Like you could prototype them now, it might be too expensive, or the technology might just like might not be there. But what is possible to do with LLMs has greatly increased the scope of what's automatable. So I do think like taking the QA Wolf model and applying that to every other industry, delivering a full solution and then automating the most expensive parts, like I think that will be a recipe for success. We're doing it in our industry and we think it's gonna work. But I think if I were to start another business, take any industry, take accounting, I'd probably partner with an accountant. But I think if you own the whole value chain and now you can automate things that were not possible to automate before and create a real competitive advantage. But I think the key to being successful there is actually doing the whole job and not just like trying to do a portion of it. The reason why QA Wolf is so compelling is because we replace the need for the whole problem. Like we solve the whole problem of QA engineering, not just a small part of it. And so we deliver a ton of value. I think the companies that do that, that solve, you know, an entire problem and not just a fraction of it, those are the ones who are gonna long-term win with AI. But who knows? Like, I don't know. I think it's an exciting, interesting times.
The general idea is like tool versus service versus just like the general idea of how, you know, I collect Chrome extensions like nobody's business. Like I am a tool like guy. I love the QA Wolf model. There are a couple other people that are doing things like we do, but tools are only ever as good as the person using them. And selling really, really does come down to human behavior. You know, we're using Salesforce. It's amazing, but there are probably like 100 things we're not doing that we could do just because we don't have the capacity or like maybe they're not the fun things to like implement or whatever they might be. Like, again, like QA has been around for 20, 30, you know, like automated QA. But the thing is, and they work well. Like if you have the resources and the time and the motivation, which is a very real thing that shouldn't be discounted. Like if you have those things to do it, like they'll work. But we're humans and this is, you know, the world and everything. And so that doesn't always happen. And so when you're able to, you know, imagine like, you know, I use a couple of SEO tools, wherever they might be. If I could get someone to use those for me for a comparable price of the tool itself, like, yeah, like why wouldn't I do that, right? And so I think one of the special sauces of like these types of companies, especially QA Wolf, is the technology that enables you to do these things, right? So John and Laura started by creating a tool that very realistically allowed you to create tests 10 times faster. It did. We even had a testimonial of like 35 times faster. But the thing is, people just didn't want to do it, like John, right? Like you just don't want to do it, no matter how easy it is. You don't want to take out the trash. You don't want to do the laundry. You'd rather have someone else do it. So now, you know, once you get past that, it comes down to like, okay, well, what's the price? And, you know, we're very real on our sales conversations, if that's what you want to call them, right? We're like, hey, if you aren't experiencing, you know, enough cost, it may not make sense to work with QA Wolf. You're not going to pay $10 to fix a $10 problem because it's break even. You might pay $10 to fix a $20 problem or a $100 problem. And so it's our job on the sales side to help you kind of like work through that and diagnose and be like, hey, it does look like, you know, your QA is actually making your developers unproductive, like 20% per week, which costs this much. Or like, hey, we found this profitability, like whatever it might be. And so it does come down to price, but the way we're able to be where we're at in the market, we deliver about 10 times the value of what maybe someone in-house can do with like a Selenium, but we're a fraction of the cost. And we're able to do that because of the technology we've created. That makes sense. That just financially makes sense for someone that owns a budget and owns a headcount inside a business. Because if they can solve that QA problem, they can now bring on another engineer, another two engineers to help them go to market faster. And so I think that's really important. And so that's why I'm very bullish on tools plus service, as long as and John said, right, it's got to solve the whole thing. It's got to do it well. That should be table stakes for any business. Solve it well and always try to go above and beyond and like keep fighting for that, right? But then the second part is like, does it make sense financially? You know, if something costs $30 million, it may not make sense unless it solves like a $100 million problem or something. So yeah, I love that idea. And I think we're very fortunate. Like the timing was awesome. They created a product that allowed us to do just that.
Thank you. We got a couple rapid fire questions. What are you both reading or listening to right now?
I'm reading Elon's biography currently. And then I'm going to get back into sci-fi because I'm looking for, I want to switch in between like work and non-work stuff. But it's really interesting. You know, he's a very first principles thinker. And that's a big part of their success in manufacturing is like, why do we need to do this way? How do we simplify it? How do we get rid of this part? How do we get rid of this process? And just the constant repetition. Like you can't just say that once and then it just happens like ongoing. Like it's you need to constantly be questioning that every day. Like he would walk the factory floor and, you know, they created like lights on the factory floors of green, red lights being if it's bottlenecked. And he would go just like walk to the red lights and ask like, why do we need this? It's a great book. I recommend it.
Scott, what about you?
Yeah, mine is very different. It's called Cashvertising. It's a marketing, sales-oriented book. You know, before sales and before marketing, you just kind of assume you know all the stuff. And then you read like, my gosh, like that's a framework for writing a compelling message or something. So that's what this book's all about. It's about like all these really awesome case studies, just how to like write well and write really clear for sales and marketing messages. It's in my top five books. I'm rereading it. So I definitely recommend it.
Founder resources that have been most helpful for you.
I don't know. See, I'm not going to answer by saying founder specific. I just read a bunch of sales and marketing books. So I don't know if like that's the best way to go about it. But I would say like definitely, you know, I'll give a plug right here. Alex Hormozi has a really great book called Million Dollar Offers. That book will get any founder from zero to one, in my opinion. It's a free audio book as well, or like digital. So that's my go-to resource.
There is one blog post. I think it was Segment.io. That was about like how to run a enterprise sales process. And they talked about like discovery call, like what's in a discovery call. I thought it was a pretty good resource for like crash course on what does enterprise sales look like. It's the first one that comes to mind. I'm trying to think if there's any others. We got introduced to, from our first investor to Jordan Wan, who runs this early stage investment firm called CoFound. And his background is he led enterprise sales teams. And he kind of gave us, you know, Scott's background's marketing, I'm an engineer. Like he gave us the crash course on how to run an enterprise sales process too. And he was really helpful. His shtick is like taking engineering heavy teams and helping them learn sales. So yeah, I definitely recommend him as well.
Two last quick questions. The next one, is there a quote or a mantra that you live by or a quote that's been resonating with you right now?
The NVIDIA CEO, I think they always say like, you know, we have 30 days of cash left. The business is going to die. We don't, you know, fix this within 30 days because they did go through that one time. And Amazon has the, you know, it's day zero philosophy. Not resting on your laurels and realizing that you're here, that's great. But like, if you want to get to where you want to get to, you need to have the urgency and realize like this company is on the path to ruin actually. The default for like QA Wolf and any company is it's on the path to ruin and you have to fight hard against that to like make it succeed. Those are really top of mind for me. If we don't solve X, Y, and Z, like we're going to go out of business is what I think about all the time. So those very much resonate. And I think it's even more important, like the larger you grow.
I have a wall of quotes that I keep handy. But one that I keep coming back to, it's by Bill Birnbach. He's one of the original like advertisers, Mad Men type of guys. And the quote is, we're so busy measuring public opinion that we forget we can mold it. We are so busy listening to statistics, we forget we can create them. That's so meaningful to me because, you know, it's like, well, hey, cold email says your average reply is on email 14. Oh, that's great. We're not average, right? Like, let's do better. Because there's someone on this side of the scale that is getting them open within like, or replied within one or three. That's always something for me is like, we're not average though. And we forget that we are such an excellent and great team that we can be the ones that set the new statistics. And it's a very hard thing. And to add to the quote, one of my favorite stories I always tell my team is the story of the 4-minute mile, Roger Bannister. I think it was like 1954 or whatever, right? Thousands of years, no one has run under the 4-minute mile. It's impossible for everyone knows. And then he breaks it. I think a month later, it gets broken and then broken again and again and again. And the whole idea, especially when you're taking on a big space like we are, is we have to run the 4-minute mile. You know, no one else has done what we're about to do. So we have to be the ones that have that persistence and like that commitment to say like, no one's done it in 1,000 years, but we're going to do it. Because when we do it, we'll know others will follow, but we're always going to be breaking that 4-minute mile.
I love it. So last question, and the walk up here for this one is, it's really like such a privilege to be able to have co-founders to join because it's such a rare insight into both how you work, how you operate, but also the dynamics of your relationship. And so in like the endeavor to help continue to cultivate great co-founding groups, like the question I want to ask is, you know, what do you value or admire most about working with each other?
There's too much to respond in such a short amount of time. But it's fun to work with friends. Like starting a company, it's very much like a journey. This should be the quote. I want to change my quote. I don't remember who said it, but like the journey is the reward. And it's so true. You get past some milestone and it's like in the past already. There's not really a place that you want to get to, and that, like, then you're happy or something. It's truly like the journey, the day-to-day, the solving hard problems, like going through the ups and downs, like that is the reward. And like, how awesome is it that I get to do it, you know, with my best friends? So I'm grateful for that. And, you know, like, I'm not gonna get into why, you know, I love Scott so much, because I can't do that in one short call, but I'm grateful to work with such a great friend who's so kind and hardworking and intelligent.
Thank you, John. I would say a couple things are really important. One is just like having the same objective. There's three of us, you know, how are we all aligning a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of a percent of us, like, being as hardworking as we are, having the same vision, being aligned, being open to feedback. Like, all these things are clicking for, like, who knows why, but they are. And I think all of us feel like so blessed to like have that happening. And so I think having the same objective, we're all putting in the same amount of work, because if you don't, I'll tell you, like, that will break down. If John is putting in more work than me or than Laura, like, that will start wearing on you. But I don't think that's been the case. Having that trust of not only enjoying going into work, going into a guest room every single morning without revenue, you got to like who you're with as well. You got to enjoy it. And that's what culture is all about, which is probably another like podcast or like a season of podcasts, right? But you got to have the culture and enjoy each other. And then not only enjoy each other, like, you each have your strengths, right? You got to be open about not having that strength and someone else filling that in for you. And John and Laura fill in so many weak spots of me. And I would assume there's some I fill in of them as well. And just being able to like be vulnerable and saying like, I'm not good at sales. I'm not good at cold calling. I've actually never connected on a cold call. And I'm not going to lie to my team, but like, I rely on them. I'm like, guys, I haven't done this. I know it's super hard, but teach me as well. And so I think there's just a level of vulnerability and just being real. Like, you know, when we started this, just be authentic. And when you're authentic and you're doing things for the right reasons, like, things are going to work out.
Yeah, it's something I was thinking many times through this call is like, QA Wolf would never exist without all three of us. Each of the things that we do, Scott helped to find product market fit, figured out sales and marketing, and continue to hit crazy, insane goals month after month, year after year, and, you know, figure out so many hard problems in that domain. I've solved a bunch of really difficult technical challenges for us to have the efficiency that we have. And like, that's my skill set. And Laura has been able to scale up the operations of the people side of the business, which is a really freaking hard problem. And if all three of us, you know, we didn't figure out how to sell, we didn't figure out how to build the tech, we didn't figure out how to scale the people, QA Wolf wouldn't exist. And so it is amazing to have like all of those come together. And the rest of our team, like, you know, we wouldn't do without our teams that we have. So it's pretty special, but we've gone through a lot. And I know, like, you know, it is day zero. If we want to get to where we want to get to, we have a lot in front of us, which is exciting because, you know, journey is the reward.
A great way to wrap up. I just want to say thank you both for opening up all of the early challenges and then the lessons that you learned along the way. I mean, I have so many quotes, even like down to the tactical specific phrases to include in an email to help convey like that sense of value, like so powerful. Like, I'm thinking even the insight of like, if people aren't responding, look around, maybe it's the wrong person, it's the wrong time, it's the wrong message. The personalization is about contextual relevance. Like, that blew my mind. And then even just like considering the strategic implications of a tools plus services model can be really impactful with the caveat that you solve the whole thing. And to think about that as like a really interesting problem space to explore. We covered a lot of stuff. So I just want to say thank you both. This was an absolute blast and I had a lot of fun.
Thank you, Patrick.
Thanks for having us. Yeah, you're an awesome question asker. So I appreciate the time.
If you enjoyed the episode, make sure that you click subscribe if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, or follow if you're listening on Spotify. And if you love the show, we also have a ton of other ways to stay involved with the engineering leadership community. To stay up to date and learn more about all of our upcoming events, our peer groups, and other programs that are going on, head to sfelc.com. That's sfelc.com. See you next time on the Engineering Leadership Podcast.